What's up, freaks? It's your boy Marty here to introduce this rip of TFTC. Sat back down with our good friend Maddie Mzingtius from Porkopolis Economics and the Crypto Voices podcast. We do this podcast quarterly. Matthew updates the global monetary base and then we talk about it. That's what we did today. Touched on a bunch of other interesting topics, including the possibility of a free banking system emerging on top of Bitcoin, the prospects of a deflationary price environment and how that will affect the economy. Maybe you'll have to work less in the future. This is a good thing. I think you guys are going to enjoy it. Long rip, great rip. It was brought to you by our good friends at Unchained Capital. They're right down the offices here from the Bitcoin Commons where I am in Austin, Texas. And they have an IRA product. If you're not using it, if you have an IRA, if you're looking to transition your IRA into Bitcoin, you also want the ability to hold your own keys. Unchained's IRA product is ideal for that, and they have the team to make it happen. If you're saving Bitcoin for the long term, it's worth considering saving in an IRA, which allows you to save Bitcoin on a tax advantage basis. Unfortunately, most Bitcoin IRA providers require you to give up control of your keys. If you've ever listened to my show, you've probably heard me talk about the dangers of not your keys, not your coins. Unchained Capital offers a solution that makes it simple for you to set up a Bitcoin IRA while keeping control of your Bitcoin keys. Through Unchained, you can take care of everything you need to set up a Bitcoin IRA, including the paperwork, purchasing Bitcoin, setting up a cold storage vault in your IRA's name, and putting the keys in your hands. To fund the IRA, you can easily transfer from an existing retirement plan or start a new IRA from scratch with traditional and Roth IRAs available. Learn more by scheduling a complimentary consultation. A member of Unchained's team will be happy to walk you through the available options and answer any questions. Schedule your consultation today at unchained.com/IRA. Tell them a TFTC sent you. This rip was also brought to you by good friends at Brains. Brains is doing incredible things. They're bringing you Brains OS Plus firmware, which is going to allow you to produce more hashes with your ASICs. If you have an ASIC that is compatible with Brains OS Plus firmware, it's an auto-tuning firmware. It allows you, again, to produce more hashes and therefore stack more sats. If you have an ASIC that's compatible and you're not using Brains OS Plus firmware, you are leaving sats on the table. It's as simple as that. Go to brains.com, BRAIINS.com. Go to their Brains OS Plus firmware page. See if your ASIC is compatible with it. And if you can download it on your ASIC, do so today. Brains is also the team behind Slush Pool, the oldest Bitcoin mining pool in Bitcoin's history, the first and the oldest. If you use Brains OS Plus firmware and you point your hash at Slush Pool, you're going to get 0% pool fees. You don't have to point your hash at Slush, though. You can point it wherever you want. They also got insights.brains.com. Go check out everything they have going on at Brains. Incredible team, incredible products. If you're a miner and you don't know what Brains is, what are you doing? What are you doing? Go check them out. Brains.com, BRAIINS.com. This rep was also brought to you by our good friends at HODL HODL, who will be hosting the Baltic Honey Badger Conference in Riga, Latvia, later this year. I just recorded with Matthew Mzingtius, who lives in Riga, Latvia. He will be there. This is one of the most high signal conferences in the world. It's September 3rd and 4th in Riga. There will be outside satellite events going on throughout the whole week. They just announced yesterday that Jack Mallers will be speaking. I will be there. I believe Michael Saylor is going to be there. I might have misspoke, but I think he's going to be there. Go to BalticHoneyBadger.com to get your tickets today, and then go check out everything HODL HODL has on the product side, which is their peer-to-peer Bitcoin exchange at hodlhodl.com. And then they have a peer-to-peer lending platform, both products, no KYC, no AML. The lending platform is lend.hodlhodl.com. You can use your Bitcoin as collateral to get stablecoin loans. Last but not least, new sponsor. Very happy, very honored to have these guys on board. This rip is also brought to you by our good friends at Upstream Data Inc. If you're a miner, whether you be an individual mining at home or a utility company or oil and gas company mining at your utility center or upstream at the well pad, Upstream Data is a manufacturer and service provider focused on building portable Bitcoin miners. They've been around since 2017. Steve Barber, the founder, is considered the godfather of oil and gas mining. They build, I am a happy customer. I have a hash hut that I'm using off-grid using a stranded natural gas well somewhere here in the United States. The uptime, I can say this as a customer, the uptime for the Hash Hut has been impeccable. The only time we've ever had downtime with our Hash Hut is when we've needed to change the oil. And it's down for 45 minutes. We change the oil, we plug it back up. I don't think we've actually missed a block yet with our Hash Hut. The uptime's impeccable. They specialize in upstream oil and gas mining. They build portable Bitcoin mining enclosures for all applications. They build natural gas Bitcoin mines for the oil and gas industry. They have at home, again, and small scale mining with their black box, which solves the problem of managing heat by enabling mining outside your home. It solves noise problems by suppressing sound. This black box does, and it solves for fire hazard problems with fire resistant box and insulation. And then again, they have industrial mining with their Hash Hut data centers. It can be modular. They can manufacture in 90 kilowatt increments up to 900 kilowatts per container. That's almost a megawatt. Would hold a lot of miners in it, a lot of ASICs. It's built in a passive heat recirculation for cold weather. They have soundproofing attachments to make sure that you're being a good neighbor. So you can go check this out at everything they have going. If you're a home miner, if you want to mine at home, you want to get those no KYC, no AML Bitcoin, and control your ASIC at your house, they have the black box. If you're upstream oil and gas, they have their Hash Huts. Again, can scale up to 90 kilowatts. I am a very happy Hash Hut customer. I'm not using a 900 kilowatt hut, but I am very happy with my hut. Again, the uptime has been impeccable. Go to www.shop.upstreamdata.ca, www.shop.upstreamdata.ca for black box and ASIC scales. If you want to... If you want to get a percentage off of those bundles, use the code FREAKS, F-R-E-A-K-S, and then Adam, this is me doing a live ad read. This is, we're making sure that FREAKS is up and live. I'm pretty sure that it is. So reach out to the Upstream Data team if you're looking for a black box, if you're looking for a Hash Hut for as a utility or an oil and gas operator wants to take advantage of stranded and wasted natural gas. Tell them that TFTC sent you. All right. They have a form especially if you're doing the oil and gas and utility mining. They have a form that you'll fill out. They'll say, how did you hear about us? Please click TFTC. Let them know that we sent you. Again, Upstream Data, Steve Barber, godfather of natural gas mining, Hash Hut, incredible product. I'm a user myself. Haven't got my black box yet. Can't wait to get it though. I will get one eventually. Enjoy this rip, freaks.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Here we are. A week later than expected, you were under the weather. But another quarter has passed, and we meet yet again to give the world an update on the global monetary base. Matthew Mezenius, how the hell are you doing?
Marty, my friend. Doing well, man. Doing well. Summer is here. No clouds in the Baltic, and doing fine. Much better this week, and glad to be back at it. Haven't done a pod in a while. I haven't done an update on the monetary base in a while, so always good to be back here with you, my friend.
Well,
and very much looking forward to the chat.
Well, the pleasure is always mine. You've updated your camera setup here. It's very crisp.
Glad to hear that.
What are you using?
This is a Sony A7S3.
Okay.
It's quite a good one. It's not the A1 or anything, the most top of the line, but it's definitely a solid, versatile video and point and shoot camera, but it's obviously much better for video.
It's very solid. You're coming in crisp. I'm a little jealous right now. We need to update our cameras here in the studio, Logan, just to let you know.
What do you guys have rolling
there? We just got some cannons.
Cannons are fine.
They're fine. I mean, there's video here. People can see me.
Yeah.
Not as crisp as you, though. Logan, let's pull up. We're going to start this on a light-handed note here, light-hearted note. We do deserve the bear market here. This is what something that you wanted to start with. We had the Winklevoss twins and their band Mars Junction. They posted a mic check. I thought they were going to have original music. It seems like they're a cover band. They're playing some Police here in this warm up. Logan, let's play the tape. All right, that's all I can take. That's all I can take. Turn it off.
Stop it. That falsetto, man. That falsetto that I think it's Tyler this is going for. Ooh.
And Tyler. That is sunk. What's the other brother's name?
Cameron.
He's just playing power chords. I mean, he did have a solo at the end of this, but just pure power chords.
You're on the East Coast, my friend. Well, no, sorry. I'm sorry. You're not on the East Coast.
I'm not on the East Coast.
You were on the East Coast. You're closer to this than me. I want to know, are people going to this? You know, what you're here to is to the ground here. What's the word in the grapevine?
I don't know. I don't know what the word is. I heard they sold the show out. And while they were playing the show, Jim and I got social engineered and some of their IRA products got ganked. Some of the coin in their IRA products. So maybe the brothers Winklevoss should be focusing on their core business instead of this.
That actually happened?
I think so, yeah. I think I saw something of that nature on Twitter the other day.
Yeah, well, there's something to be said about, you know, if you just hit so many home runs in your young career as these bright young gentlemen have done, I guess at some point you just gotta try something new, do something a little different. They went for it, man.
I mean, I don't know if they still hold, but at least at one point they publicly announced that they wanted to hold 1% of the total Bitcoin supply, 210,000 Bitcoin. So,
no, I believe they still do. I'm sure that would have been a whale alert long ago if those coins had moved, but I'm fairly sure that they did a Shamir secret share, I believe, across like all the main banks in the United States with their keys, as far as I know.
Is that overkill?
It's a bit interesting in that you would put your keys all into a bank. That's one thing. Of course, there's redundancy there, and it's I guess it's not major banks. I heard this, you know, regional banks, mid-level banks, they had all around, but in different safe deposit boxes. And of course, if one gets compromised, they can go to many, many more. But
at Mars Junction has 1% of the total Bitcoin supply.
Mars Junction.
I hope I get that rich one day where I could just pay people to come listen to me sing. It sounded like the actual Police record was playing. They were just like singing along with it.
Right. And it sounded like they just don't care anymore.
Yeah.
They were doing right there.
So do we deserve this bear market? Are we officially in a bear market, would you say?
That was a great tweet there. By,
Autism Capital.
Autism Capital, yeah. But now I don't worry about that stuff, man. I don't worry about it. Your listeners shouldn't worry about it. No investment advice, right? But, you know, this is why I track things like the monetary base. I enjoy it. Have fun with it. Try to see where we really stand in the monetary world, and you know, the rest will come to us, I think.
Yeah. And so this is why we meet here once a quarter to talk about the now Porkopolis economics quarterly monetary base update. Bitcoin has fallen two spots to the ninth largest monetary base, with gold and silver included in that monetary base calculation. Bitcoin was number 7 after Q4 2021. Obviously, we were hovering around all-time highs in the middle of that quarter. So it makes sense that if we fall about 50%, that Bitcoin would get knocked down a couple notches. But before we get into the details of the quarter-on-quarter changes in the monetary base, you were just in Oslo, right? So I think we're not giving investment advice here. Bitcoin is a tool that empowers individuals the world over. What was your experience like in Oslo, and were you educating people about the monetary properties of Bitcoin there?
I was, yeah, a little bit, best I could. We had a nice CBDC panel. A few people, Odell was hosting that. Janine was on that, who actually I just interviewed yesterday. She'll be on the pod. And yeah, it was just really simple, short, could have been much, much longer. As always, I like tangents. I like to talk about this stuff, but it was only 20 minutes. So it's very, 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 very basic. But yeah, the topic was CBDCs, the dangers of CBDCs, and CBDCs are sort of they're
the tyranny that comes with them.
Yeah, well, yeah, they're being quoted a lot. Apparently, there are some 100 central banks that are interested, fascinated by the idea of a CBDC. So we just wanted to talk about what that really meant, where that fit into the actual money supply, what that actual money supply looked like, if CBDCs are going to be a thing anytime soon or not. I gave some opinions on that, which we can talk about in a second. Just some of the dangers that come with them, because this would be something that would be on a central bank level, something that they can turn on or off at whim. And people should be aware of that if they think this is going to be some tool for financial salvation or financial freedom or financial efficiency, especially if you are a dissident or someone who's trying to work yourself out of an oppressive regime to help people that are suffering from human rights abuses across the planet. So kudos to Gladstein for making it happen. I was very actually happy to be a part of that. As he said, it was, the first CBDC panel at a human rights conference. So that was cool. But this stuff is, Bill Browder, who has always interesting things to say about Russia. He billionaire investor from that was in Russia in the 90s after the collapse of the Soviet Union. He was not at the human rights conference, though he usually was, because Davos was a little bit later this year. He was funny. He gave a video address, and he was like, they say that the Oslo Freedom Forum is like the Davos for human rights. Unfortunately, I have to be at the Davos for anti-human rights while I'm missing you there. And that's true. He was in the real Davos, which was, is always getting more and more of a shit show every year. He was there. He gave a message that just talked again about everything that he's doing to try to stop oppression around the world with his Magnitsky Act, which we don't have to get too into. There's definitely some things there that I wouldn't agree with as a libertarian. But as far as putting a stop to just these crazy kleptocrats and dictators that want to come to Western countries to sit on their yachts or send their kids to school in Western schools and enjoy all of the nice things about the Western world, which they claim to hate in their home countries, which they rule with an iron fist. Actually, I think that's quite well intentioned. I think it's not going to do anything to stop the war in Ukraine, for example. But I do think that we as a society, whether you're in France, Germany, Spain, Italy, wherever, if you want crooks and backwards dictators to come to your shores and have their kids go to your school and all the rest, you can let that happen. That's been going on now for decades. But I think we are at an inflection point where people are standing up, at least in Europe, and they're saying look, just no more. This is just way too backwards. It's way too paradoxical that you're having these people come in and just enjoying everything that we have to offer in places that, by and large, respect human rights. You know, we might not agree with everything the system does, but by and large, these places agree. You know, Western, they have Western values. Like, you know, if you're not going to adhere to that in your own country, then we don't want you here. So I do think that visa control, passport control, residency control, you know, it harkens back to things like immigration issues that you'd have in the U.S. for different reasons. There's argument, good arguments on both sides with borders and immigration and stuff the libertarians take. But regardless, what specifically what's going on in Europe, specifically with these, you know, kleptocrats in North Africa or the Mid-East or in Russia, just coming and hanging out in, you know, in Cannes or in
Monaco, you know,
in the Italian Riviera or in Monaco, like that's just got to stop. And, you know, do I think that's going to be done in a completely transparent and great way? That's great for all the taxpayers. Probably not. But I do think, like, this is pretty interesting stuff that's happening with politicians having to directly answer to their constituents and saying, like, why are you allowing this to happen again and again and again, where just these absolute crooks and kleptocrats are just hanging out, you know, enjoying the fruits of our labor, enjoying our sunshine, and then they just go back and they're just murdering people, raping people, all the rest back in their home country. So it's interesting. It's interesting. Yeah. And those are the discussions, you know, you have at a place like Oslo Freedom Forum.
Yeah, there's hypocrisy on all sides. I mean, like you said, we have it here in the United States. I mean, one of the big news items of the last couple of weeks has been Nancy Pelosi's husband got wrapped up in a DUI charge in Northern California. Got a little too tipsy in wine country, driving around Napa Valley, pissed drunk. Apparently hit a car or was involved in an accident. Who knows who hit who? But there's rumors going around that DUI charge is going to get swept under the rug. So you have the Pelosi's, Nancy being one of the most powerful politicians in the United States, actively insider trading against the American public during the day and then driving around pissed drunk at night with impunity. There's a spectrum to this, obviously. They're not raping and pillaging individual Americans, but man, there's this two-tiered system that exists throughout the power structure of our world.
100%, man. 100%. On that side, I mean, when you look at that, when beating 90% of the market and, you know, her visa connections were clear and all these other things, I mean, it's embarrassing. I don't think there's an easy answer to any of this. I mean, as a libertarian, as a classical liberal, as someone who's a fan of, you know, freedom as a Bitcoiner, we just got to keep doing what we're doing, educate, talk about the good things, you know, stay true to our morals.
Yeah.
And then we're definitely in an inflection point, new world here after Ukraine. I mean, it's huge. I wanted to ask you, we talked about it a little bit last show. I know you have a lot of guests and listeners who probably disagree with our views in Eastern Europe, but did you get positive feedback? Did you get negative feedback?
Mixture of both. So you were on after, you were the immediate episode after we had the dude who writes a serious report. He's an English gentleman, and he gave the case that there was a lot of instigation from the West encroaching on Russia's borders with NATO. What am I looking for? Bases and all that. And he gave the instigator's perspective on that. And then you came and gave the European perspective. And obviously, so there's mixed reviews. My conclusion after having those back-to-back episodes and the reaction to those is that it's all fucked. Like we just said, like there's a spectrum to this. Obviously, the Putin regime is on one extreme of the spectrum. And as I articulated the last time we spoke, like I'm not happy at all with the leaders that we have here in the United States and in the West. And their provocations. And I think people like yourself, myself, most importantly, Ukrainian and Russian citizens just get fucking thrown in the middle of these proxy wars that, yeah, at the end of the day, individual Russians, individual Ukrainians, individual Americans, Latvians, just want to raise their families, live a good life, and live an honest life. And we're thrust into these geopolitical dick measuring contests between psychopathic kleptocrats, again, that exist on both sides of the aisle. And I do think that's why we focus on Bitcoin, because it helps us get away from these people from all angles. So, yeah, mixed reviews. A lot of people really appreciated your perspective. I appreciate your perspective because I, again, like we discussed last time you were on, I am that American is pissed off at his government for just, I would like to apply a Ron Paul foreign policy here in the United States, where it's like, hey, leave everybody else alone and just focus on fixing our problems here in the United States, which are pretty material and seem to be mounting day by day. I think meddling in other people's affairs is just making us worse off in the long run.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we don't have to rehash the Ukraine thing, but I can say, first of all, completely agree. I mean, I'm a classical liberal libertarian here in Eastern Europe, you know, on the one of the fronts of Russia and Belarus and all the problems. So I've thought about this a long time. I've had a lot of friends over here, and I think I said it, I say it on most shows or interviews, like Europeans, classical liberal Europeans, they have very different views than my typical example is the Texas libertarian, which, you know, now you're out of Jersey, you're out of New York, you're in Texas. You have that view, which I understand very well. You know, don't even need to describe it. Everybody should know when I say Texas libertarian what that means. So good. It's totally good. And I think that there's no problem keeping with your principles, staying consistent. And, you know, as a libertarian from a small country that's suffered from those proxy wars, from those occupations, indirectly, you know, my family is of immediate Latvian descent, grew up in the States, went back afterwards, and now, you know, shit's happening again. This is all like super real for us, and not just me being a foreign Latvian. I mean, everybody knows it here. People's grandparents shipped to Siberia, whatever. We had all this shit. We've gone through all of it. So the fact that it's going on again, that they're trying to do this imperialism again, like, we're just going to stand up for it. But that doesn't mean that, you know, if, you know, I see interesting things happening in a Libertarian Party in the United States, you know, with the Mises Caucus, like, that doesn't mean that people can't rise up, gain followers and people that believe in their ideas and change policy, and I would be fine with it. I mean, if the United States wants to completely leave NATO, I'd be fine with it. We have enough power and will and strength here now, I think, to defend ourselves, which is very, very good. And as for the argument, which I don't know who this gentleman is that you're talking about, I didn't see the episode or anything, but if I presume it was the typical argument about NATO encroachment. I don't want to rehash all that, but it should be obvious now after a few months. It's very interesting what's happening in Europe, in Northern Europe. In particular, you have Sweden and Finland who are ready to join NATO after literally, you know, Sweden, 200 years of a neutral foreign policy. Finland famously avoided occupation, unlike the Baltics, which did not avoid it. They avoided Soviet occupation, won the Winter War, stood for peace. They still suffered greatly. I mean, if they had taken the deal that Stalin offered them, they would have theoretically lost less land and lost less troops. But you never know if Soviets would have invaded later. So they actually stuck up to they stuck up for themselves. They rose up and gave the Russians an unbelievable fight in the Winter War to start a World War II. And they were kind of neutral as well, had this sort of, was a term they don't really like, this Finlandization, which is basically a completely neutral and also slightly communistic view, where you really accepted communist and Soviet views as something that maybe should be thought about and researched and everything. So a little bit communist, the Finns, just because they had to be. They had to be where they were in their history, like their geographic location and everything.
Yeah, they're on the eastern border of Russia, correct?
The western border.
Western border, Russia. Yes, western border.
Border, yeah.
China's on it.
Thousands of, yeah, China's the other way. But, you know, thousands of miles of border with Russia. And so I will debate anybody about this. I have no problem debating the NATO expansion thing. I think I said it on the last show with you as well. Like, you know, this aggressive NATO expansion or this, you know, thumb in the eye of the Russians, the Baltics were the last ones to come in, really. The last, like, big countries or countries that were, like, kind of close to Soviet-type occupations. Yeah, there was, like, Croatia and North Macedonia came in later. But the Baltics and Poland and... you know, Hungary, these types of nations, they came in, actually Hungary a little bit earlier, but Baltics and Czech Republic, Slovakia, they came in 2004. Like, that is a long time ago. That's plenty of time for Putin to think if it was really NATO that caused him to somehow invade a sovereign country. And, you know, people that were like young infantry men and women now were barely a twinkle in their father's eye when the Baltics came into NATO. So this is nothing new. This is nothing that caught them off guard. And back to the elephant in the room here, the amazing thing of the last 3 months is like Finland and Sweden, they're going to join. I mean, Turkey is going to yield to them. And that they want to join. Everybody wants this sovereignty. They have agency to choose their own security. Like, they don't want to deal with this shit. It's modern, you know, it's 21st century, 2022. This is real for them. This is Europe. We want freedom. We want normalcy. We want free trade and all the rest. But you just can't be going in and causing, you know, rapes, pillaging, and murdering, sending, you know, washers and dryers back to East Russia just because you want them and just because you want to dominate Ukraine. Point being, it's obvious it's not about NATO. If it's about NATO, if this NATO is such a big deal for Putin, why isn't he going and invading Finland right now? Finland's joining NATO. Stop him. Go in. Go. Make a provocation. A NATO country cannot join if it has a provocation with another country. So do it. Putin should go in, cause a, you know, as the Soviets did during World War II, cause, you know, dress up a border guard in Russian clothes. Say that border guard was shot, and, you know, and then that's a provocation for, you know, for entering or starting something. Start a provocation, absolutely. That, like, why not do it? And the answer is obviously he's not going to do it because it was never about NATO. It was never about this Western encroachment. It's about Putin being a crazy kleptocrat who wants to dominate Ukraine, and he wants to dominate this former Soviet space that he knows is still relatively corrupt, and that he can, you know, take their oil and resources and all the rest, and their wheat and their grain. So, I mean, it's, you know, but anyway, the point is, I would be totally fine if the Americans got out of NATO. And I think a modern classical liberal position would be, you know, have them get out of NATO, have local alliances only, you know, I mean, but we need the alliances, like the Baltics need it. Poland, you know, Hungary's got their issues with Orban. He's a bit crazy these days. But, you know, the Czechs, the Slovaks, Romanians, Bulgarians, Croatians, all these people, they want normal lives. And now you include the Skandics into that. Like, they're not ever going back to the days of World War II. So I'm actually very heartened to see the alliance get stronger from that side. As someone who holds, you know, a Latvian passport, as someone who's a European, also with an American background, also as an American, I'm totally fine if the Americans would like leave the alliance. I would also say good luck making that happen politically. As we know, there's too many crazy interests that are going to try to assert themselves, and that's a whole nother issue, which is bad. It's absolutely bad. But, you know,
yeah, that's my whole. Maybe it's wishful thinking, but I mean, there's so many factors here and so many moving variables at play. Number one being, like, you make the argument that Europe and the West sort of shifted leverage in Putin's favor with idiotic energy policy over the last two decades. Like, there's, I would like to see, like, as I don't ever, I don't know if maybe I am libertarian. I've never described myself. I don't like to throw a label on myself. I do think maybe this is libertarian. I'm just being like a hardo, trying not to put a label on it. But I do believe free markets can liberate the world. That's why I focus on Bitcoin predominantly here. And this media platform that I have, and I don't think free markets, particularly in energy, were able to flourish throughout Europe over the last two decades. And that shifted a lot of leverage into Putin's hands, as he has control of the fuel source of Western Europe. And I think one can make a very strong case that the invasion of Ukraine would have been significantly less likely if Putin didn't have that chess piece to play of having all the leverage over Europe's energy sources. Which obviously the invasion has created a energy and food crisis, or exacerbated an energy and food crisis, to a point where people are having to buy gas and oil and rubles, and they're having to pretend like they're not doing that by buying Russian petroleum products from India, or going to the middle of the sea and buy it. I think we need to liberate markets from these central planners, whether they be in Russia, in Ukraine, the rest of Europe, or here in the United States, and just let us peaceful citizens interact with each other and conduct commerce with each other. I don't like the ginning up of more saber rattling on the war front in terms of alliances and focusing on a solution via force with strengthening NATO and stuff like that. I think what Europe should do, what the United States should do, is realize that they made very large strategic errors, particularly via energy policy, that has shifted leverage into Putin's hands. And instead of trying to brute force and exacerbate an already terrible situation of war and potentially push the world into World War III, like, Western leaders should be a bit introspective and own up to the mistakes they made on a policy, from a policy perspective, and try to fix that to hopefully mitigate any potential escalation of physical conflict moving forward. But it doesn't seem like that's happening at all. And the Western government seem to be doubling and tripling down on idiotic energy policy. So that's where I stand right now.
Yeah, it's hard to... it's hard to not see politicians not taking the mantle here, beating their chest, showing this effete sort of intellectualism and this faux leadership. Like, unfortunately, this is what politics is sort of geared to, right? It's like, should be typically dealing with these big outside issues. But unfortunately, you've fucked everything up over the last 20 years, as you've alluded to, all of these different things, from energy to labor, to commerce, whatever. And now this war gives politicians an excuse to do more bad things. So yeah. I understand it. I mean, it gives someone like Trudeau, who literally just imposed financial Armageddon and martial law on his citizens, like, the next week, to go to Europe and act like he was some champion for freedom, because he sent, you know, Ukraine some vests or whatever. So it's not an easy solution, but it is also, you know, it's another view that I take, and whatever, we can move on to the actually, you know, talking about something more concrete, like the, like,
well, I
the
think this tweet provides a good segue.
Yeah, I think it does. But it's also an opinion of mine, basically, in that, you know, if you go back to this idea of just, okay, Europe has always suffered from wars and infighting and all the rest. We're not at a place where we have, like, private insurance, private defense contracts. We're all rich enough to have our own sovereign flag, you know, 8 billion sovereign flags, not just 200. We don't have to outsource things like, you know, we're not in the position where we don't have to outsource things like military and political decisions for, you know, things that we don't want to partake in. So we're very, very far from that, whatever that utopia might mean. And I know we never get to a utopia, but we're very, very, you know, it's 100 years, 1,000 years. We're very, very far from it today. So focus on what you can. That's concrete. That's Bitcoin. And then regarding the political stuff, I would just say, I would implore, because I know, I assume, as you said, it's mixed reviews, but I would assume a lot of your listeners are these types of libertarians who, why would they care at all what's happening in Europe and whatnot? And fair enough. I mean, I have no problem with that. I would just say, you know, try to be sensitive to people that are suffering. It's not the United States' fault what Vladimir Putin is doing. It's just not. And you know, I can provide books and links and all sorts of things to talk about his 20-year thing. But from the beginning, they had started this. The election in 2000 was basically set up for him to win, and there's been no legal election ever since by an independent fact checker and all this the rest. So the democracy stuff in 2022 is just, it might not be working in the United States as we want it. Definitely not working in Russia.
I think you'd have to be an idiot not to concede that fact.
Yeah. So it's you know, we're a long way. So that's about it, really.
Yeah.
You also think the interesting question would be, like, say United States gets that, right? Say we get a proper scaling down of government, right? I mean, how likely is that? I hope it is. Not sure. But let's say we get a reasonable, not crisis-induced Libertarian Party, Mises Caucus, just explodes in popularity. Let's say we get a moderate, reasonable scaling back of military, U.S. troops in Germany come home. Lots of things happen where the United States shores up its troops literally and its budget, you know, economically. Great. Question would be, at what point does the United States ever come back if their European friends screw things up again, or a group of European friends such as, you know, or enemies such as Russia, Russians just coming in and doing the bad things that they're doing? It's an interesting question, you know, because I don't think it's needed at the moment. Like I said, I think the libertarian thing to do, the classical liberal thing to do, Thomas Jefferson said, I'll trade with everyone, alliance with no one. He also started the whiskey tax and did a lot of other bad things. It's like, you know, if you really think that you can get to that ideal, that classical liberal idea, that American ideal, whatever that is, great. I just wonder how the American society would react if Europe falls apart again. And we probably will with something. It's not going to be as bad as the Nazis, but look, I mean, we had to come in as an alliance, to stop, to the Nazis. And, you know, history could have been a lot different if we'd even gone farther. I mean, again, I'm speaking from an Eastern, we suffered both from the Nazis and from the Soviets. So, you know, don't forget, like, Churchill wanted to go all the way to Moscow, but they decided that it was not worth the cost. And Russia's never been the same. I mean, Russia suffers from 100-year problem of communism. Just moronic, stupid people that thought that they were being righteous and legitimate, and they tore down generations of people. So that's going to continue. Like I said, I would absolutely be glad if Americans could shore up their resources and go home and clean up their own. But I don't know. It's weird. There's going to be.
Well, it all comes back to energy. Like, energy is the base of human action. Like, it literally, if you want to get to the bare minimum, like, you spend energy to go hunt and eat. Like, that is the basis of human action. And I what the fuck happened in 1971? For some reason, we went off the gold standard and idiotic energy policy began to follow from that. And I don't think Europe is going to be in a good position until they again, show some introspection and realize that their energy policy has put them in a very precarious and vulnerable situation. It doesn't seem like, I mean, Germany, the economic powerhouse of Europe, seems to be doubling and tripling down, shutting down nuclear power plants in favor of unreliable wind. And that's the other thing. So I've been having a lot of conversations. I went on a libertarian focused podcast the other week, and even though I'm very happy to see that the Mises Caucus has taken over the Libertarian Party and jolted some life into the libertarian movement and actually brought some power to that perspective in the political landscape here in the United States. Again, like, I don't think we solve this by getting a libertarian in office. I don't think we solve this by getting a Republican or a Democrat in office or voting our way through this. Like, I do believe the Hayekian view of we're not going to, I think you need to fix the money to fix the world, and you don't fix the money until you take it out of the hands of the government. So even though there's great things going on in the Libertarian Party, I think it's a losing battle in the long run, because they're just going to be thrust into the administrative state that is pretty, it doesn't care who is in power in that hierarchical structure at any given point in time. The administrative state just views those politicians as a facade for the public to look at and interact with, where that's, again, why we focus on Bitcoin, because you actually take the most important tool that humans use, money, out of the hands of the government, so that you can then begin to take steps towards fixing these structural, systemic problems that exist throughout our global economy. And then that's why, like, a libertarian podcast went on, I was like, stop, like, debating Democrats, Republicans, and other libertarians about making policy change. Just go fucking build the world that you want to see, and Bitcoin provides us the opportunity to do that. And
again, what was the response?
It was open to it. Like, that's the thing. Most people don't understand that Bitcoin is this open source, global distributed network that you can plug into and fortify at any point that you decide to. I think I did have a bit of a breakthrough there, where it's like, let's stop going to Vegas and trying to gin up support and create solidarity within the Libertarian Party so that you can then go up against the Democrats and the Republican on the national stage. It's just like, don't even play that game. Just come play this game that's completely separate from that system, which is Bitcoin. And you'll find that obviously the most positive externality of that is you get better money, which allows you to facilitate more peaceful and direct economic activity. And then you have the positive externalities that fall from that, which one of the first and most profound externalities is the impact on energy. It makes energy, particularly stranded and waste energy, more profitable, which allows you to bring more abundant energy to the world, which over time, yes, we're not going to solve this problem overnight, will lead to less conflict, because people have the bare necessities that they need to fulfill the lower end of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And so when it comes to trying to fix this problem via Washington or via the EU or trying to shake Putin or take Putin out or whatever, like, I think it's all noise at the end of the day and doesn't actually have us making steps in the right direction, whereas Bitcoin is that mechanism through which we can begin to carve a path in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Amen, brother. Completely agree with you.
Yeah.
And I'm glad, I'm actually very glad as well that any libertarian sort of thinker, or even Ron Paul, people that might be asked by professional news agencies to come on their shows or even their YouTube channel, that none of them will go on RT anymore. So that's good. For about the whole 2010s, they were all getting on RT because RT was loving their views against the big bad US government. And I was like, oh my God, you guys have no idea what you're doing. Please stop it.
Well,
and now people see what RT is no different than NPR, which those people claim that they hate so much. So, yeah. My God.
Come on TFTC, where we'll have level-headed conversations about this. Because it is, one of the favorite buzzwords of the show is nuance. There's so much nuance to this, and it's not something that can be fixed overnight. But that's why, again, I like to focus on Bitcoin, because I believe, could be wrong, I don't think I am, but I believe it provides us with the best mechanism to separate ourselves from that geopolitical proxy war that humanity is suffering from.
100%. It is interesting, though. I mean, like, you know, David Friedman called it the hard problem, and I never used to dwell on defense, the issue of national defense. And again, we just don't have this 8 billion sovereign flags, private defense, free market, very low cost energy sort of world that we want yet. So where we are right now, it does yield different reactions and perspectives from many classical liberals or people or Bitcoiners or whoever. And I know that, you know, again, I know this is a very US based audience, but you're going to hear many different views on defense from European classical liberals, European Bitcoiners. And but I got friends from the Swedish Mises Institute that are sending me like Swedish video, like Swedish propaganda videos of their military with like the Swedish like glory music, Viking music and stuff. See, and like, you used to tell me that everybody else was the biggest statist in the world, and now you're sending me this stuff. And they're like, well, in this case, I understand, you know, it's
that's one thing I worry about, though, is like the fog of war.
I grew up in Ohio, man. I never thought about, you know, the things that the people that came before me had to deal with in Europe. I never had to experience it. Of course, we protested it and tried to understand that stuff in the late 80s to get freedom for Eastern Europe. But now that it's coming back, that freedom is in flux and threatened again, directly for poor Ukrainians who never quite got out of it. You know, Baltics got away, thank God, as fast as they could from any sphere of influence, which apparently some people in the U.S. think we should have under Putin. But again, I don't want to get back and sucked into that rabbit hole. But, you know, I just never had to think about it until now. And now you, when you're here, you know, you have your family here, your daughter here, your, you know, some extended family. Think about what might happen. If you would stay and fight, if you would go. We've had these discussions for years and years, but when it actually comes down to it and you see the horrid, horrid conditions that they're dealing with in Ukraine, it definitely makes you think. And like I said, it's not just me. It's not just people in the Baltics. I mean, you know, Swedes, Finns, everybody's thinking about it differently now over here. So it's a very different conversation than you probably have if you just keep it within, you know, thoughts on Ukraine from afar with a bunch of I'm not trying to sound pejorative, but with a bunch of tech libertarian. I mean, you're gonna get different views. You're gonna get vast views. So I wish we had it, man. I really do. I wish we had that world, but well, I'm all for Bitcoin getting us where we need to be, but right now here in 2022, it's definitely thought provoking. If not much worse, depending on where you live.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all fucked, man. I mean, curse. You got the Chinese proverb /curse. May you live in interesting times. And as time goes on, the times only get more interesting. And where we find ourselves today, transitioning into the digital age and this hyper-connected world that we live in. Humanity trying to come to grips with the pace of growth, I believe, is the pace of change. Maybe not even necessarily growth in and of itself, is forcing us to attempt to rewire our brains rather quickly, which as animals, as chemical beings, as animals, it's hard to come to grips with that pace of change and make clear, cogent, assertive decisions. But I think we'll get there. Again, that's why we focus on Bitcoin. It's not going to fix everything overnight, but I, again, believe it allows us to take steps in the right direction. We're taking the first baby steps that hopefully will lead to something that makes the world a better place for your daughter, my son, my child that I thought was going to arrive last week, but seems to be a bit stubborn. We got to make these small steps so that they can run, to bring a cheesy saying. Or
they're going to make a good Bitcoiner with that stubbornness. It's important.
Yes. Yes, it is important. Well, I mentioned
about our world just yet.
I mentioned a segue earlier, and what I wanted to segue to was revert back to what we were discussing earlier, which was CBDCs. And so viewed as a segue, because with all this going on, and obviously we have economic sanctions against Russia, and the financial global community seems to be bifurcating, and the Davos class seems to think that CBDCs are a good way to prevent kinetic warfare, or use CBDCs to punish people in the physical world. And what's going to happen if CBDCs do come to market? I'm a bit skeptical. I don't think the administrative state has the technical capabilities to actually bring it to fruition. Obviously, there is a counter example to that in China and their social credit system and everything they have going on there. But how would CBDCs, let's run down the thought experiment of them being successful, how would they affect what you do on a quarter by quarter basis with your monetary base update?
Yeah, good question. Totally agree with you. And if we can go to its tweets. I know we got to talk through this for the radio, for the pod, but shoot. 1 second. It's tweet 15. First of all, you remember, I think it was, I got to write this stuff down. I always say it, but
always say it every episode.
Every episode. It was your, I think it was your pod where I first started to talk about it. One of the first interviews we did, maybe the first interview we did, 2018. Was it started 2019? I'm not sure. Where I think it was 2018. I said then, I continue to say now, I'm extremely skeptical about CBDCs. I don't think they work economically. I don't think they, like you just said, could work technically. You have massive risk factors there. You think about all the threat mitigation that Bitcoiners go through. Like, you think the state is going to be able to handle that, to be able to hold a candle even close to that? So I've always been skeptical about the technical sort of adoption of CBDCs. And on top of that, you got something that's much better. Yeah, I know we're Bitcoiners here, but you got something that's much better and easier to use in the form of stable coins. And stable coins are going to be a thing that they're going to try to regulate first. That's what I said like 4 years ago in our first interview. And that's what's happening. So CBDCs are still very much a technical, marketed sort of thought experiment worldwide. Now it's 100 central banks are researching it, all the rest. China started it with the Beijing Olympics, all the rest. Let's go through a few things here with this slide. So this is the good old global monetary base. Everything in the world, whether you have an account, whether you have a stable coin, anything but Bitcoin or a dollar bill that you hold in your pocket, or a euro or a yen, everything is fiduciary media, which means it's not money that settles immediately, ultimately, the core of the financial system. Everything but Bitcoin, gold, silver, traditionally, historically. And today, base money being those notes that the central bank prints. Also, they print some money for a lot of money for the banking system. Those are called the bank reserves. Those two things together in the current modern financial system, that is the monetary base. Okay, that's the ultimate settlement. That's how the system settles. That's how banks settle with one another. That's with each other. That's how you and I settle with our proverbial coffee shop when we buy that coffee. The system's the transaction is done fully final if we hand over a note that is legal tender printed from the government. So that's what this slide is. I got to work on the contrast, obviously. Anybody to read. But this one is, there's two, you can see two different blobs there, obviously growing like crazy. And the actual amount that they grow is about 13% per year since 1970. So that's one, that's about 1% a month. Compounded gets you to 13% a year, not 12%. So 1% a month, compounded since 1970 gets you some from something that was, you know, couple hundred billion dollars equivalent. And I'm not talking just dollars here. This is worldwide figure. This is 50 central banks. Couple hundred billion dollars in 1970 to $30 trillion today. And that's a lot of money. Okay. This is cash money. This isn't Elon Musk borrowing on his Tesla shares to buy Twitter, leveraging something you called fiduciary media. Everything is fiduciary media. Except for base money. This is actual money, cash money. It's a lot of money, right? $30,000 billion. $30,000 billion of actual money. Now, not all dollars. Some is yen, some is euros, some is yuan, Korean won, Argentinian pesos, Brazilian real, and all the rest. That's on this chart, all right? This is the printing press of the central bank. This is base money. We've talked about it now for many, many quarters. This is actually the 16th update, so the fourth full year doing this. Happy to show this to everybody because this is it. BIS is going to show you this. IMF's not going to show you this. This is the one. All right, this is the proverbial printing press of the central bank. So the wholesale money is the bank reserves, right? That's basically how the Fed really gets money into the system. Or any central bank. Okay, that's when they're buying typically government bonds. And when they buy those bonds, they take them out of the system, but they buy them with money that they just created to get into the system. So that's how they increase the money supply on a quick way, on a fast way, on a high-powered way. It's called high-powered money. So that's the light shaded area. Those are bank reserves or wholesale money. None of that is going to be CBDC. It already works. It's electronic. There's banks. The big banks probably control 75 to 80% of the monetary base anyway of those bank reserves. So think about that. You're talking about a handful of banks. I know this is a fact for the US, and I presume it's a fact for Europe, but I don't know for sure because they don't publish. At least I haven't seen the data. But all of that white, lighter shaded area, right? So it's like $21 trillion equivalent. $21 trillion, $21,000 billion worth of base money. All right, which is the core of the financial system. It's how banks settle with each other. That is controlled by a handful of banks in each country, okay, in each market, in each currency market. So why would you need a CBDC for that? It already works. It's not like everybody knows their Federal Reserve Board governor at the big bank, Jamie Dimon, gives, you know, anybody from the New York Fed a call, anybody from the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. a call. It's not a problem. Like, it's not a mystery who these people are. They all are working. You know, this is something that Rothbard has been writing about. Many people have been writing about. It's been going on for decades and decades. Like, that's not the issue. So that CBDCs are not going there. It's not going to be wholesale bank money currency that we're talking about. We're talking about CBDCs. We're talking about the darker shaded area on that chart, which at present is about $9.2 trillion, a lot of money, $9,200 billion equivalent of cash. So that's the actual cash, like the physical cash money all around the world, floating around and under mattresses and in safes and in grocery tills and all the rest. That's money in the system. That's what they want to be the CBDC. All right. So whatever Bloomberg talks about, whatever CNBC talks about, whatever the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England talks about, they're just blowing smoke up your ass. They have no idea actually how much money is in the monetary base. So here it is. This is the answer. It's a lot of money. And I said this at the Oslo Freedom Forum as well. I asked you a simple question, Marty. Do you think for both of those items, is that chart, is it going up or is it going down? Is it going up in a gentle direction? Is it going up quite fast? Which way is the number going?
Someone describe it as hockey stick growth.
Yes. So number is going up there. All right. This is the only thing that they know how to do. And cash is a huge part of society. Like, we don't have to wax and wane too much on this, but on this particular point. But like, you just So here's the thing, actually. Odell did a poll, which is typical. We knew that the poll would be taken, of basically asking, okay, so how many people are you actually using physical cash today? And it was the vast majority, minority, a few people in that room raised their hand when he asked that question. And I understand that. But the thing is, they're not representative of the globe, and they're not representative of just billions of people that would be destroyed if you tried to just overnight shut down the system, go to some mysterious CBDC based on your phone system of money. It's not going to happen anytime soon. It's not going to happen. The numbers are out of control in the favor of paper money and paper currency. And no matter how much they're trying to regulate it, shut it down, we were in Norway of all places. I mean, Norway is famously, over the last like 15 years, trying to be the cashless society. And of course, they can, because they have about $220,000 worth of pension funds sitting in every citizen's account. $220,000 per citizen is about the pension fund size of Norway. It's about $1.3 trillion. That's on the Norwegian Central Bank's balance sheet. So they actually have a very, very small monetary base in Norway. It's actually the smallest of all 50 that I calculate, typically. Sometimes it fluctuates, but it's the smallest. But they have a huge line item of real assets. Unlike you and me, who, you know, I'm not even getting any Social Security, but you, Marty, you're not either. I mean, there's no money that's in the pension funds or any unfunded liability account of the United States government. So when people say, like, the Social Security is bankrupt in the US, it doesn't mean that they're taking in less money than they're earning in taxes. They are, and they have been cash flow negative since 2011. But what it means is that the money's gone. Like the money, when people say that Social Security is bankrupt, it actually has been already lent out to another branch of the government, military, agriculture department, whatever, and it's been spent. So any money that would need to come back into this, I can't even remember the number right now, actually, of what the Social Security unfunded liability figure is, our pension fund, our quote unquote pension fund, in the United States. It's trillions of dollars.
I think it's just between like 7 and 9 trillion or something like that.
Yeah, it's trillions of dollars. And that's not there. It's literally money that has to be taxed twice. It's just sitting there. It's like the government owes that money to itself. So the Social Security Department is owed that money from, say, the military or from some other branch of the government. But it's not there either, right? They only make money. And the government makes a shit ton of money every year in taxes, right? It's like $4 trillion, I think. Maybe more now. Might be a couple-year-old figure, actually. But trillions and trillions of dollars. It's the biggest organization in the world that collects money forcefully or not forcefully from anybody. Okay, it's massive. But it goes out right away, immediately. The Social Security has been not cash flow positive since 2011. So why do I bring all that up? Basically, even a place like Norway, ironically, a place like Norway is the only country in the world that really has a strong pension fund that's like actually has they have hard assets in there. They have oil assets in there. They have a decent amount of gold on their balance sheet. They have actual assets for their constituents, for the citizens. That doesn't exist in the United States. It doesn't exist in many, many Western European countries, and certainly doesn't exist anywhere else in these kleptocratic countries. So there's not actually money there. Having a digital currency would. And so here's the rub of why this isn't going to work economically. The banking system needs deposits to work. Okay. Let's not talk about whether it's a fraud or not, lending money in the banking system. The banking system needs deposits to be profitable. If banks don't have deposits, they can't loan those deposits out and make money on the interest. It's just not going to work. The idea of CBDC is we remove physical cash from society. That physical cash, which is on the central bank's balance sheet right now, on the central bank's balance sheet, $9 trillion globally. That would then switch to this sort of these digital currencies that could be much more controlled. They would argue efficient, but really it means controlled, censorable, turn on, turn off, tell you if you've had too much alcohol, plug into every vendor's digital currency account. So basically there's no cash that's sitting in a grocery till. There's no cash that's sitting in safes or under beds. We get rid of that. Also, we can control interest rates that way, but you know, we'll not worry about that. Everything is controlled at the central bank level. It sounds like a communist, you know, manifesto. It sounds like a communist dream, and it is. But there's no way, especially in the deep markets of Europe and the United States, there's no way it would work. Because what would it would do? And all the papers acknowledge this, by the way. All the papers on CBDCs by central banks, they all acknowledge that it's a tremendous challenge or drag on the financial system's profitability if you were to have deposits leave the banking system. Just like, hey, you know, I got PayPal, I got Venmo, I got my banking app, whatever. It might work, might not work, might not be that good. But, you know, at least I have that, right? That's what the average person is saying. I'm fine with it. But if you come in as the central government and say, hey, we got a central bank account for you, it's going to be much better. Use it. We're making you use it. That money does go away from the banks. It means that the deposits that you hold with your banks, it goes away. So that's a massive drag on the financial system, which is why it's never going to work in mass in capitalist societies. The only society it might work in right now with any legs is China, because obviously they're communists. They don't care about their people. They want to control their people. And anyway, it's an extremely digitized payment processing system with Tencent and Alipay. So that's the only one which maybe they can make it work, because anyway, they have all these communist style resources and they don't have a fully private banking system. So that's where we'll probably, and everybody knows, that's where we are seeing some innovation, let's say, in CBDCs.
Yeah. Yeah, CBDCs, so put it another way, as succinctly as possible, they just cut out the commercial banking system, which is what allows you to go take out loans and take risk and get access to capital markets to go operate as an entrepreneur, as a capitalistic entrepreneur throughout the economy. So if you're going to replace that deposit system with a direct connection to the central banking system and use that as your access to the monetary system alone, it completely cuts out all those services that the commercial banking system provides the world.
Exactly. And they know this. They know this. It's written. I mean, this is the discussions they're having. This is the crucial discussions. But they're blowing a lot of smoke. You know, it makes news stories. It makes Bloomberg, CNBC, all the stuff. The numbers show that it's never going to work that way. First of all, cash is way too hard to take out of the system. I mean, so many people will suffer. India tried to do it, by the way, in 2016. They took out two types of bills.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember which ones. Because
it was like a 500 rupee bill. And
Yeah, something like that, right? And they wanted better digitization, serialized bills, sort of things that you can digitally check easier with those bills. That's what they wanted to do. It's a control measure, right? Completely messed up the Indian economy for a few months. It was down from, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was way down. Collapsed the money supply in like half in a few months. And now, 3 years later, it's like triple. So they didn't keep it down. It didn't help sort of banks sort. It was still, they're still physical notes they replaced it with. But it didn't like help banks sort of get a better judge of who needed the bills, where the bills were going. That was the idea. Okay, it might have helped a little bit, but it's not like they kept the money supply down. It's three times more than it was in 2016, the Indian rupee in physical currency. So it's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen. The numbers don't make any sense for CBDC, both on the physical currency side, actually mattering for a society transacting, which is mostly needs to do that daily trade of, you know, in and out of physical cash. Like, you know, maybe in certain Western places, we don't have to do that. We can afford to just wait a little bit, use PayPal, Venmo, or, you know, eventually we're going to use Lightning, things like that. It's just, there's no way that the vast majority of the world is going to handle anything like this CBDC. And here ties it back now to what I was talking about with the unfunded liabilities, the pension funds, all these other things. The state can't manage any of those assets, and central bank can't help it either. So there's no way that like that money will have to be, will probably be issued. And then in return, they'll buy more bonds because of it, right? Because that's the only way you balance the central bank balance sheet is you issue something, you print it out of thin air, and then you take something out of the market, which is typically a government bond. We can actually talk about why they do that and why it affects interest rates, but just in pure mechanical form, that's what happens. So they can't manage any of that stuff. They can't manage the pension funds. They can't manage, like, you think the bank is going to be, you know, just like the state bank, the central bank is just going to be some new, innovative, amazing manager of a pension. But the only country that can do this is Norway. And that's because of the oil, it's because of the history, it's because of the amount of population, the geography, all sorts of things.
It's scalable in Norway. It's not scalable here in the United States or...
United States, not in Europe wide. Did you see that interview? You saw that interview with Christine Lagarde. Amazing. Oh, yeah.
In due course.
I used to think she was smoother in these interviews. She was speechless.
Well, let's give credit to the moderator of that town hall meeting. He put her feet to the fire.
Yeah. Yeah. Who was that guy, by the way?
Some Dutch guy. I don't know.
Yeah, that was solid. That was solid. She was speechless. She could not explain how that balance sheet is going to be normalized, how it's going to come down. And as we all know, because we actually follow this stuff, and I'm sure any listener to this show knows, it's never coming back down. It's never going to be normalized. This is the new normal, and it's going to keep being the new normal. Inflation, inflation, inflation. That's how it works.
Well, another good segue. You were saying we can explain how the Fed creates interest rates. So like people say, like, all right, the Fed will come out and they want to raise rates 50 bips. They don't just go into a computer and say, like, all right, now the Fed funds rate is 50 bips, right? Like you were mentioning with the creation of money and the purchase or selling and taking money out of the system of bonds, they interest rate target. So they attempt to either create, if they're lowering rates and they want to target a lower rate, they'll create money and then they'll buy these treasury bonds from the commercial banking system and attempt to get the Fed funds rate at that level. They don't set it, yeah. They target it, and then they use the creation of new money and the purchasing of assets to get to that rate. Is that a correct explanation?
Absolutely. And I always take it one level deeper. I say, why did they do this in the first place, right? Why are they buying government bonds? Why don't they buy gold or real estate? They used to buy gold, but why don't they buy real estate? Why don't they buy corporate debt? Now they're starting to do that now, but let's put that aside still. Why don't they buy stocks? They could buy anything they wanted. The reason, let's just take it to the deepest level. Why does a central bank buy government bonds? The reason is because they are a buyer that if that buyer did not otherwise exist, the price of their related company, of their sister government, the price of their government's debt would be higher. It's a hard thing to understand sometimes. Interest rates have an inverse relate. The price of debt has an inverse relationship with interest rates, right? So the interest rate is lower, the price is higher. It's more expensive, okay? But if the price is lower, the interest rate is higher. Or if the interest rate is higher, the price is lower. The value is lower. So what they are doing, why does the central bank buy government debt? It props up the price, because typically they go down, right? They don't go up. It's only done once in the 1980s. Paul Volcker took interest rates 20%. Typically, the rates go lower and lower and lower, typically. What does that mean? It means the price of the debt is going up. It means it's higher than it otherwise would have been if that buyer of government bonds was not in the marketplace. So that's really like the core of central banking right there. That goes back to British times, like the sovereign being bailed out by the banks and monopolizing the banks. But what the Bank of England, like the first modern central bank, it's just to prop up the government. It's to prop up government. It's to make government debt more expensive than it otherwise would be in a free market. And that typically means higher price means a lower interest rate. So you always hear about lowering rates, lower. It's not about like gearing up at its core. It's not about, you know, gearing the economy up and making rates cheaper for all of us so we can get the economy back on track. It's just to make government debt more expensive than otherwise would be.
What another way to put that is to make it look better than it is, like so to artificially give it what the market would deem a higher rating in terms of like AAA, AA, BBB. Yeah.
Precisely. To be a buyer of last resort, to be a buyer that just would not exist in the absence of that monopoly. You'd have a competitive market, a free market. You'd have more arbitrage situations. You'd have more call-outs of bad organizations like you do on a local level. Because remember, still local governments can still go bankrupt, and they do. State governments can still go bankrupt, and they do. The federal government never goes bankrupt because it's always supported by the Federal Reserve. And that's the same as any other modern economy is supported by its central bank. But really what it means at its core, it doesn't mean economic growth. It doesn't mean full employment. It doesn't mean low inflation. It means at its core, the reason they buy government bonds is to give it, precisely as you said, Marty, to give it, to just make it look better than it otherwise would. Why they buy it. There's no other reason for it. That's the core. That's the core of the reason. And that's what their balance sheet looks like. So that's what you're going to start to see with more easily printed digital money would be you would issue it. And then as you issue that, you would buy more government debt. So it'd be an even easier way to do that. But of course, it comes with all the Orwellian things as well, bells and whistles that we all know would happen. But there's just no way, man. There's no way they're going to pull it off. The pressure is huge.
It's massive. Pressure,
yeah. So it's amazing how much they're talking about it. I know it sounds like I'm dealing in free real estate here. I'm not putting money on it or whatever, but I've said it for years. I don't see it happening in the United States in particular. The dollar has too much to lose. As far as just where it is right now, it's certainly not needed at a bank level, right? So on that whole
the banks hate the idea of it, right? Because they get cut out of the whole situation.
Yeah, it's in all the papers. No. It's not a. Everybody knows it. They all know that it's a challenge deep down. Like they know that they can't make this thing profitable for the banks. It only works in a monopolized communist Orwellian type of a situation where you have CBDC on a central banking platform, a central banking app.
Yeah. Yeah. Imagine the app the Federal Reserve will create. Did you see for all the shit we get the Federal Reserve, I do love the St. Louis Federal Reserve database. But did you see the article they came out with this week?
No.
Comparing the price of a carton of eggs as measured in dollars versus Bitcoin. They like tried to dunk on Bitcoin. They did the time frame was January 2021 through April of this year. And they tried to dunk on Bitcoin because Bitcoin obviously was volatile with the price movements. But if you look at the overall inflation rate of a dozen eggs as measured in sats, it was something like 44% in the dollar. Inflation rate over that same time frame was 77%. And they were like, look at all this fluctuating volatility in Bitcoin. But it's like, at the end of the day, you had a higher inflation rate. And then they allowed you to zoom out on the chart all the way back to January 2015. And if you did that, the price of eggs in Bitcoin fell by 99% and it rose by 19% in dollars. So yeah, they seem a bit confused in their messaging and attempts to attack Bitcoin.
Looking at it right now.
Yeah.
Oh, moronic. I mean, there's no hope for these guys. There's no hope. I mean, the only way that they can get on as they get on is because of that monopoly privilege. That's all there comes down to it. That's all there's to it.
Well, so a lot has changed in the central banking system since we last met. Obviously, we've had interest rate targeting, Federal Reserve targeting a higher interest rate. We had quantitative tightening begin within the last couple of weeks here. And obviously that's having a massive effect on the monetary and banking system. And there's, I mean, we had a negative GDP print in Q1 of this year. It seems like with all the data that's been rolling in month on month since that GDP print came in, it's looking likely that we'll have another negative GDP print here in Q2. 2022, inflation still rising. You had the Fed trying to tame that inflation. What, number one, is the Fed doing from a monetary policy perspective? How would you describe the mechanisms of what they're doing? And number two, how would you describe the predicament they're in terms of GDP falling, inflation staying elevated, and seeming like it's not going to come down anytime soon, and the decisions they have to make later this summer or into the fall?
Well, you saw, was it Bullard before a week or so ago, who one of the governors, who after they were talking about, okay, we're going to have to eventually hike even more, again, you know, take some base money out of the system in order to increase interest rates. We're going to have to do that a little bit more this year. That will help to curb inflation fears. Might not curb actual inflation, price inflation, but it might curb inflation fears. And that's what we might have to do. And then Bullard just said like a week or two ago, it's like, oh yeah, but after that, we can start talking about another cut again. They're already talking about a cut while they're talking about increases. So it's both sides of their mouth as always. And I don't actually have any more, I'm not ready to make any other predictions, as I am like with the broad stuff about the trends of base money other than that. But I will say, we should always be very clear about what this price inflation stuff means. And in my opinion, it means absolutely nothing. Just like this article you just pointed out about the eggs, which I'm looking at, which is hilarious in Bitcoin terms. You gotta, like John Williams, Shadow Stats, I know you probably say it a lot on your show, Marty, but I will never, I finally get into a point, by the way, where I'm going to start doing some YouTube videos, and I have a good charting engine that's coming, and I have a lot of good data that I've collected over the years, just like this monetary base stuff, and I really try to dig into a lot of these money supplies, what it means, what's the actual growth, how might that compare to GDP and other things, and population and all the rest. But I say all that just to point out that I will never, ever in a billion years have a CPI index in one of these charts. Never. And I just don't think it's worth the time of anybody to try to decipher it either. I mean, if you're going to read something from the Fed, it's going to be gobbledygook. That's absolutely going to support their position. And if you even try to see, like, I remember talking about one of these times how just hilarious how there was like a Bloomberg article that tried to decipher the two different types of inflation, like had tried to tie them together because there's like one that's from the BLS and one from the Fed. They're quoted differently. They're defined differently. And of course, any sort of, be proper on our terms here, right? So the Austrian traditional definition is an increase in the stock of money. That's what I track with monetary base, the traditional inflation. This stuff, which really they've been really going hard since like the 90s. That's when we started doing the price inflation targets and stuff. This stuff is just made up. I mean, it's literally, filet mignons and, Cornish hens in your hedonic of your meat one quarter. And then it's, ground chuck the next. I mean, they're just changing the hedonics, the underlying variables of these systems. And it's just a simple index. Like it's free real estate. No one can check these things. No one has any, it's not open source. No one has any idea what these things mean. And John Williams himself has said, and he continues to say, that it's double. It's at least double the real inflation, the real price inflation rate of goods has to be at least double. But I would even take it a step further and just not say, don't waste your time with this stuff, because it's much more informative to look at real asset growth. Look at the price of gold. Look at the stock of gold. Look at the stock of the monetary base. If you want to look at GDP, that's another one that's like very iffy. Fine, look at GDP, but don't go much further than that. Like, look at stock prices, actual stock prices that you can verify with an index on an exchange that's traded, and we know it's traded. Okay, those can change in definition for sure. but it's a free market that like is a relatively free market, right? So those sending are
relatively strong price signals.
Yes. Yes. Look at the Bitcoin price. Look at the stock of Bitcoins. Those are the things that really always interest me. And I just think it's noise, man. I mean, how many times have, like, you and I talked about this, or you and I'm sure plenty of guests, it's, and they don't, it's not the right definition, right? I mean, we've lost that battle, unfortunately. Like I always try to say money inflation versus price inflation. I try to be specific. I forget, you know, plenty of times, but it's just not the right definition. It's, but I think we've lost that battle. Inflation is typically defined as the central bank defines it, which is a general increase in the price level. But the problem is you just can't define that. You cannot define that. And if they define it, they're going to define it to their whim, not to yours.
Yeah. So, who was the Austrian? Was it Mises who said inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomena?
That was Friedman.
Friedman. Yeah.
So what he meant was price inflation is always and everywhere a monetary growth inflation phenomenon, which is what I like to follow and what I'm trying to calculate in that monetary base. Those numbers that I was telling you about, that 13% per year compounded figure, that's monetary inflation. That's monetary inflation that always and everywhere will cause price inflation.
Yeah. I don't want to be that guy, but I want to bring it up. Like, if obviously we have attempts at quantitative tightening right now and a lowering of the monetary base, the nature of credit markets specifically is going to curb the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world's ability to do that for a prolonged period of time, considering the supply chain problems that exist throughout the world, creating very, very dire supply side problems for people to get essential resources, and the fact that new central banks are going to have to revert course and begin expanding the monetary base even more, because as you've described, it's their only way out. Does the word hyperinflation begin to seep into your mind?
Impossible to predict.
That's why I said I don't want to be that guy, but there's a social aspect to it too. So if you think of Bullard, Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve Board here, Christine Lagarde over in Europe, and it's like there's cracks in the social aspect of central banking that are beginning to show. That town hall meeting in the Netherlands, which Christine Lagarde was nervously laughing and just hand waving the ECB's future movements to unwind that balance sheet away. And then we have Jerome Powell here saying that he's dead set on curbing price inflation here in the United States via interest rate policy. And it's going to become glaringly obvious, I think, at some point later this year that even though they attempted to curb that price inflation with aggressive interest rate hikes relative to what the Fed has done in recent decades, that's going to prove to be ineffective to curb the runaway prices in food and energy specifically. And at that point, does the public go, oh shit, these people don't have any control over this? And then does the social aspect of hyperinflation begin to creep into the situation where people begin to panic and part ways with their dollars and euros as quickly as possible to get the assets they need to survive?
Yep. I think that positive feedback loop is inherent in any system. It certainly is inherent in a banking system. Would not be inherent in a 100% fully reserved banking system, although I'm not an advocate for that or really care, I guess, one way or another. It could work in a Bitcoin world, might not work in a Bitcoin world. I'm a fan of free market systems, right? Where you have the market forces, which are going to, if one bank decides to aggressively lend or be aggressive in their behaviors, other banks would quickly keep that bank in check by claiming other assets on them, whether it's gold in the vaults or Bitcoin, in the wallets if they can. So that would be the ideal system, I guess, for me, what I'd say is. And with this system, that positive feedback loop is massive, because you have this government that we've talked about, the central bank relationship between the government, where anytime that there is a crack, the solution is to paper over it, literally and figuratively. So, you know, again, I'm always hesitant to say that there comes a point, but you are right that would exactly be the scenario. It's a positive feedback loop. That feedback loop is exacerbated under this monopolized system more than it would be under any free banking system, more than it would be under any Bitcoin system. It's certainly more macro as well. So if you had a free banking system where, you know, one town decided to go crazy on, you know, real estate, that would typically be an isolated thing, or at least, it would typically be an isolated thing. It's the idea for free market banking system. Here, it's global. As we talked about, the reserves, all this stuff, when you're talking about the interest rates, all that money that flows in and out, it's flowing out of just a few banks. It's like a handful of banks, less than 10, say for 75 to 80% of those reserves. So it's extremely centralized. It's extremely top down. And those are all recipes for monetary disaster if that positive feedback loop begins. It's just, again, look at the numbers, look at the trends, look at the trajectory. Those things, I know you're not a doom and gloomer here, and I'm not either. Like, we are optimistic about Bitcoin here. And I do think Bitcoin is going to play a role, which we can get to. But it is very dangerous. What I will say as well, what I wanted to say about this point is, for all the problems Europe has with wars and all the rest, you know, the Germans in particular, they know the dangers of hyperinflation. Like, they really know it, like, to their core. And that is partly the saving grace, I think, of Europe, of the Eurozone system. You know, gold is actually a mandated part of the Eurozone system. There are different things that Europe has that the United States doesn't. There's a bit more checks. Of course, you have these not good comments, which are not positively worsened comments.
Not confidence inducing at all.
Yeah, not confidence inducing from the leader of said bank. Nor really good legislation pieces that have been coming out lately. There's a lot of negatives in the negative column. Even though I do think that as a whole, the people do understand in Europe really how bad things could get. So you would think that they would try to hold their leaders a bit more accountable to that. But, this is something I cannot make a prediction on. I don't know the time. No one knows the time. For sure, no one can predict hyperinflation. It's a monster that can just come at any time. It's happened hundreds of times in the last 30 years.
Yeah. It's a social event horizon, right? There's obviously the mechanical expansion of the monetary base that comes into play, but it's talked about a lot on this show because I mention it as much as possible, but many people in the mainstream and in the outside world completely discount the social aspect of hyperinflation. It's a confidence game as well.
It is absolutely a confidence game because of that monopoly. Like, if you didn't have that, you wouldn't have this shenanigans, this data and everything else. You just wouldn't. It's not something inherent to free markets, right? Like, we don't have to worry about this in any other product. Why do we worry about it with our banking product? It's from that side. It's just so, I know I'm speaking to the choir here. I know that I am. Please, dear listener, I know that I'm speaking to the choir.
Well, I don't think so, because I agree with you. I'm actually partial towards Hal Finney's view of Bitcoin's future, where you have a free banking system that is built on top of a Bitcoin standard, where I think a lot of listeners are believers in fully reserved, Bitcoin-backed global banking system. But I do think there's going to be a free banking system built on Bitcoin. It is enabled. And it's actually something I wanted to bring up with you, because you were in Oslo and having talked to Odell about the experience there and what people were talking about. Chami and Mintz were a big discussion there. And I think as a Bitcoiner, looking at what Eric Sirian, Obi, and Justin Moon are building with the Fediment protocol, that provides a mechanism that could have a free banking system flourish on top of Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the mechanism of Lightning in general is I want to call it fiduciary. There's a quote. I was actually literally just talking about this with Rodolfo recently this week. See if I can find it. I'll pull it up here for you. But I have this quote, say, from Peter Todd from like 2018 on Lightning in general, which applies to this. I'll pull it up. But basically, the idea is that, yeah. First of all, broad point. I would even you know, be more agnostic, as you said. Like, I totally think that Finian view could happen. Totally think that it could happen with this system of balances that can be transported, Bitcoin-based balances that can be transported outside of the main chain under different rules, different circumstances, different users, different use cases. Absolutely a believer that could happen. And if that does happen, it would be a unique new type of money that had never been seen before. Because I do think that it's not quite accurate to call Lightning a fiduciary system. It's also not quite accurate to call it. It's certainly not the rules of Bitcoin. So Peter Todd, I can't even find it right now, but Peter Todd said in 2018, quote, I still have. Save close, basically said it's a middle ground state where it's not quite a claim, but it's also not quite under your control, the balance. It's possible if the sender really, really wanted to attempt, although he would be penalized, it's possible that he could maybe succeed in reclaiming the payment. That was sort of it was a threat about senders reclaiming. That was the discussion. This was 4 years ago. But that idea applies to all this stuff that can be built on top, and I think it's a good description. All right, so your deposit account, your bank account, a stable coin, which we haven't talked about yet, all of those things are fiduciary media. They are managed by a third party. All that fiduciary media means, it's a money, and it's fine to call it money, no problem. Like PayPal, Venmo, just call it money, whatever you wish. Go crazy. All of that stuff is fiduciary media. It is is media that is managed by a third party on your behalf to settle. Some are better than others. Some can do quicker than others. But it's not base money. Okay, so base money is those dollars. Base money is gold. Base money is Bitcoin. This system is very interesting, I think, that could happen. All of these systems on Lightning. And it's not... I would not go so far yet to say that it's a fiduciary media, but it's something, it's probably something different. It's probably something new and unique, and it's a payment that would not have existed before. And if you really wanted to get back to base money, if you're worried for some reason, first of all, you don't need to have many funds on there at all. And if you wanted to get back to base money Bitcoin, it would take a matter of seconds to minutes to do so, which is unlike anything that you can have in the current financial system. So
is this a good change? Is this a good change in your mind?
Sorry?
Is this a good change in your mind? Or good evolution?
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. I mean, so again, to be fully agnostic, which I really am as far as how a free market banking system could go, I'm not an advocate for having a free market system that's definitely like fractional reserve, and you have people that argue about this stuff. Like, you might have a free market system, you might have a narrow banking system, you might have a fractional reserve system, you might have a fully reserved system. The rub is, none of that's going to happen anymore. And it's been dead for 100 years because of central banking. So it's really just mental masturbation at this point anyway. That's why I don't like these fractional reserve arguments with Austrians. I know you're not going there, and I agree with you 100% with the way that you put it with the Finian view, but it's just mental masturbation. It's never going to go anywhere. It's a dead idea because we have these central banks that are fully in control and fully monopolize the system. Only way is that Hayekian sly roundabout way where we can get around the state money, and that's obviously Bitcoin. The next step do we go back to like this fully anarchic free market system? I don't know. What do you think? I don't think anytime soon. So it's, again, it's built on top of Bitcoin and something in parallel that probably is more free market, might be black, might use that word black market, but it's a system that's in parallel for a while.
Yeah. I mean, I think the mechanism is certainly there to produce that anarchic system you just described. Yeah, it does. Do the social tendencies of the market lead us there? That's the question. Do people want that? Who knows? The beauty is like we're having these tools built that will allow people to go explore those options if they so wish. And that's,
I think it's like the Ukraine discussion, you know. I mean, it's like this is deep, we're talking about deep security, deep levels of freedom, gatekeepers. You know, it was a Gary North quote I loved a while back. Gary North, rest in peace, who just hated Bitcoin. He thought it was a total Ponzi scheme. Old school economist, libertarian. I don't know if listeners might have read him. Interesting writing, but he said in one of his speeches, which is not a unique really thing to him, but you're talking about academia and Ivy League and banking and all this stuff. It's just like all the gatekeepers are still here, but the walls are just, they're down, you know? So the gatekeepers are going to hang around, but you can literally walk around them,
yeah,
you know, into the castle, into home, or into wherever you want to go. I mean, the walls are down. So that's really cool. It's absolutely not going to change. Doesn't matter. Like Loomis regulations, legislation doesn't matter to me. I don't think about it. I don't worry about it.
I think this is something we really need to, if obviously Bitcoiners like to talk, we're in a meme war, narrative is very important, but I think in terms of educating individuals outside the Bitcoin bubble and or earnestly trying to explore Bitcoin as a solution is to highlight what you just did, is that the walls are down. And again, like I was expounding on this libertarian focus podcast a couple of weeks ago, like we don't need to play within this mechanism anymore, this administrative state. Like we can, the walls are down, we can go walk around them and do it over here. It's just, again, getting a lot of social talk in this podcast, like just getting it through people's thick skulls that you have the ability to take this particular action and focus your attention and your work and your life force here, as opposed to trying to fight an upstream battle with an impossible battle that you're never going to win with the administrative state. It's just trying, how do we, and maybe it's not the responsibility of Bitcoiners, individuals like you and I who believe that this is the right way to go. How do we convince more people, or do we have the ability to convince them? Maybe people just need to come to this realization on their own.
It's not a vein, I don't think. You know, I wouldn't call it a responsibility, but I would call it a, you know, privilege. I mean, it's not in vain to do this stuff for sure.
Yeah. I always love these conversations. Should we get back to like the monetary base? What should we highlight? Q1 20?
Yeah.
21.
Do you like the info?
I do. I do. I like the new design overhaul. Matt and I were talking on last week's RHR. He's very happy that you're rebranding the Porkopolis Economics over Crypto Voices.
He always tries to tell me this. I'm like, dude, you know that I don't care at all. I appreciate your enthusiasm there, but you know, long before it was a crime to label something crypto,
yeah,
I just didn't. Still don't care, but it's still there. The podcast is still called Crypto Voices, and it's a sister brand still there, much to, I guess.
So, like I mentioned earlier in the conversation, Q4 2021 to Q1 2022, Bitcoin fell from the seventh spot in the world monetary base standings to the ninth spot.
Can we look at 18?
18. Yes, sir.
I hope that
it's a very divergent chart there. What's going on here?
Yeah, so this was probably,
it's a bar chart.
Too much for this for this forum. But let me just describe it. I would encourage listeners to check it out. But this is I think it's called a tornado chart. So on the left you have GDP per capita of all of these countries. And it's not all countries, right? So you have the Eurozone as one block. You know, you could think of the United Kingdom, I guess, as one block. There's many countries in that, but it's the currency blocks, right? On the left and the right. GDP on the left and the black, GDP per capita. And on the right is monetary base per capita. And as number one, as we talked about there, is Norway. So the monetary base is minuscule. Like, I don't know if you can
barely see it.
It's $1,500. You know, I'm just going to say dollars. No, understand when I say that it's not dollars. It's Norwegian kroner. It's Danish kroner, all the rest. So $1,600 equivalent per person in Norway. Okay. And again, that's cash. That's Norwegian kroner per person. All right. But they have that $1.2, $1.3 trillion sovereign wealth pension fund sitting on their balance sheet as well. So they don't, there's many reasons why they can go for this sort of cashless society, and they can try to do this virtue signaling and all the rest, the ESG and all the rest. It's, you know, this is the Scandic way, right? I highly doubt that they would do that if they didn't have this ridiculous pension fund that has, if you look at any other bar there to the right, this would be dwarfed. Okay, Switzerland is number two, by the way. It's 94,000 per person, but obviously Swiss francs is a huge currency. It's traded everywhere. It's traded in, you know, China. I mean, Swiss francs is a huge currency, so obviously the Swiss francs are not all in Switzerland. Neither are the dollars, but still, it's a way to look at it. $94,000 per person in Switzerland. Norway has 1,600. But if you look at that pension fund again, it's $220,000 per person in Norway. It's just insane. It's remarkable that they've done that. All the rest, but you got to think about these things when you start thinking about like what a CBDC is going to look like in all of these countries. I mean, there's no good asset that, you know, those central banks can try to manage and work, hold something together. Norway is just very, very unique. All they're going to do is, as we've talked about ad nauseum here, is they're going to buy government bonds, make the government look better than it would otherwise look if the central bank wasn't there, and put money into the system and take the bonds out of the system, therefore increasing the price, lowering the rate, lowering the yield, lowering the interest rate. So Norway is a very unique beast, very interesting beast there. Very small base money per capita compared to like the wealth of its people, the size of its economy, which is the largest economy per capita in the world. So one of, I should say, I don't know if there's maybe there's European Union one, and I'm going EU wide there or Eurozone wide. So anyway, sorry, another tangent. So you have that there. You have the USA is about $18,000 per person is the monetary base. $18,000. Just think about that. That's not $18,000 in your bank account. That's $18,000, like cash, absolute cash money. Of course, the US dollar is global currency, the world's quote reserve currency. Other central banks like to hold dollars, all the rest. So it's many, many dollars that are outside of the United States, but you know, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money per person that is printed. And, you know,
a country of 330 million people.
Yeah. I will leave it up to the listener to think if that money is like, you know, if that's indicative of how the average person feels, that, you know, if they feel that like they have the resources to merit, you know, that much money.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you've heard the stat that gets thrown around often, your average American, I believe 60%, probably more now, I would imagine today, compared to when the stat was popular a few years ago. 60% of your American citizens couldn't afford a $400 emergency expense without going into debt.
No savings, yep. 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 So
I doubt if you were to poll your average American man on the streets, yeah, they would feel that $18,000 is indicative of.
Yeah, it's massive. It's massive. I mean, why would you have this money other than to be sitting as base money somewhere close to your control? I mean, like, that's what, you know, that's what money should be, right? Just that. Think about that. $18,000, and yes, I understand the number's probably lower because
it's an international
huge portion of those dollars. $100 bills are more outside the U.S. than inside the U.S. I understand that, but nonetheless, I mean, that's just.
I mean, even if it's off by a factor of 10, your average American would still be like, yeah.
$400 expense. Yeah. Factor of 10. That's a good way to put it. Jesus. So, and then another one, obviously, which is interesting, which is crazy, is Japan. A little bit down the list as far as the economy goes. I didn't put that number in the description there, but it's, I don't know, 10. Actually, the economy is huge, gross, right? It's like the third biggest economy in the world. If you count Eurozone as one block, it's the third biggest economy, I believe, and third or fourth. But per capita, way down. All right, so this is interesting because Japan has famously been printing money for 30 years to get themselves out of the Nikkei bust. And $45,000 equivalent yen per person in Japan. Very rich country, very expensive country. I'm not sure.
Very terrible demographic situation over there right now.
I'd like to talk some Japanese as well to feel how they feel about that. Like, again, base money, you know, you should at least have a pretty good portion of that in your coffers, in your private coffers, ready for, as you said, emergency expenses for your family, for heirlooms, passing things on, for your nest egg, savings. It's a hell of a lot of money. And all that money is in Japan, by the way. Yen is not, like, unless you speak Japanese, you're not doing business in Japan, right? So it's $45,000 worth of yen that they have per capita. It's a massive balance sheet, as you've asked me about before. Sometimes it's been number one,
mm-hmm,
in these quarterly updates. So they're printing money. They've done it for 30 years. They continue. You know, again, why would we expect anything to be different as time goes on? So I think it's an interesting one.
Yeah. Well, you can't expect anything because, again, like we've described, the mechanisms of the way this monopolized monetary system and this wedding of the central banking system and the governments that are printing all this debt, like, mechanically, this can't be unwound, right?
Mathematically, mechanically, no way. Not possible.
Yeah.
What do you think about, so we talk a lot about inflation, right, in the current system, the modern system, and a lot of people wonder about a Bitcoin system, if it would have, you know, deflationary effects. What do you think about that as time goes on?
I mean, I believe that. I think Jeff Booth, Price of Tomorrow, the point he makes in that book is very enlightening, where we've had, especially in the tech sector, in terms of software and iPhones and computers and the productivity increases that they've brought us and their relative price compared to decades ago. We've had extreme price deflation in those areas despite the monetary expansion that the world has experienced over the course of that time in parallel. And obviously we've had stock, real estate inflation, to healthcare, education, whatever, to counteract that deflationary pressures in the technology sector. I don't see why moving to a sounder monetary system or sound monetary system wouldn't bring those deflationary pressures to those parts of the economy as well. I mean, I'm a believer that stocks, real estate, education, healthcare are being artificially propped up, prices at least, of those services and goods because of the monetary expansion. Could be simple understanding. Maybe there's more nuance that I'm not seeing, but just.
No, agreed. I think it's absolutely going to be the case. I mean, it was the case in the classical gold standard. Prices gently fell, you know, over a few hundred years, you know, in the U.S., pre like worldwide classical gold standard, but in the U.S. In particular, but other countries as well with these types of gold back, gold based dollar or pound or Norwegian kroner based systems. So prices did gently fall, and it would be, I think, very good to get back to that. But you always get this weird concern from people that that would like somehow be a bad thing if we had gently falling prices.
I mean, it's bad for, it just forces lenders to be more risk averse with, because it's bad for lenders at the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
So you,
yeah. Well, it's bad. It's potentially bad for borrowers, actually. So now, like now would be a good time, obviously, with inflation. If you could get money, buy Bitcoin, right? If you could take a loan to buy Bitcoin, that would be a great thing because you don't have to pay that loan back in this fixed lower.
I mixed that up. It's bad for borrowers. So like if you're going to borrow money, you got to be sure that what you're going to bring to market is going to outpace that deflationary pressure.
Does Booth think that, I don't know his opinion on this, and I've wondering if you know, but like, cause some people think that there like won't be like lending in this type of market or it can't work. You know his opinion?
I can't speak for Jeff. No, I don't know his exact opinion on that, but again, if you play this,
I think it's interesting because, like one of another objection, let's say, which I think is related, but it's, I think it's easily solvable is like some, you know, like these free bankers, right? Like Selgin, White, as far as I know, they would think that if you get into a deflationary price deflationary system and you don't necessarily have other inflating factors to counteract that, and you did have inflating factors in the gold systems, right? Because gold, unlike Bitcoin, was not fixed. It's still, it is fixed in the ground, but it still increases, you know, every year, right?
Yeah, miners would go out and
mine asteroids, whatever, you know. Alchemy, I know for sure. I remember talking about this with Adam back. Like, gold has been created. It's extremely expensive to do it, but gold has been created in a lab. So it can be done regardless. You can create gold if you want. You can, you know, you can mine more gold. You can get gold. So there's an inflationary pressure, population, all the other things. They wonder if it becomes too awkward if deflationary pressures still counteract that. And then you get to the point where your labor would, like, what would you do? Like, you know, do you have to give price cuts to profitable good companies? And my opinion to that is absolutely wrong way to look at it.
You'd fix it on the supply side, wouldn't you?
I think you'd be even simpler. You just let them work shorter hours. Like in the, like today it's okay, work the same or harder and we'll give you a wage increase in a currency that's inflating. In the other scenario, it's like we're all being more productive and better.
Go enjoy your life.
I'll pay you the same, work less. Yeah. I think that's the simple answer to that. But I haven't heard if anybody's actually addressed it that way. But I definitely think that that's the goal, right? It's like we want machines. Not in a dystopian AI way, but we want machines. We want technology to help us. It's obvious that that's happening in the current tech world, even amidst this inflationary, monetary inflationary pressure and price inflationary pressure. But in a deflationary or a no inflationary environment of Bitcoin, you would just have the ability to have the same output, have the same growth. You still have population growth, still have all the rest, but you just work less. So,
work less? Hey, people reading more books, toiling in the land. Sounds like a great future.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah.
That's, I don't know. I don't know what what others are thinking about that. But I think that's the case. And I do think that you'd still have lending. But yeah, like you said, it would just be more risk-averse borrowers. You'd have to be much more careful as a borrower.
Imagine there'd be... businesses would switch to like a bootstrap model, which is easier in today's day and age in the digital world. It's significantly easier to bootstrap a company and provide utility to the world. Obviously, with capital intensive hard asset endeavors, it's not the same case, but much harder to bootstrap. But
yeah, bootstrapping as in using other service providers to get started in your endeavor.
Yeah, or just running as lean as possible until you get traction, and using cash flows and profits to reinvest instead of going out and getting debt.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's great, man. I mean, all of these things are fantastic. We got to keep promoting free banking. We got to keep promoting free markets. It's not going to happen. We know this. It's the hard problem of defense is hard. The hard problem of central banks is hard to get around. But like, you know, that's a good way to put it. Like you said, you know, I mean, just keep educating the fact that the walls are down, and then you know, that's where I think the hope lies.
Yeah, and end it on a white pill, on a hopeful note. You can do it. You can do it today. You're listening out there. Go download a Bitcoin wallet. If you're a merchant, the tools that allow you to receive dollars and auto convert all those dollars or a portion of those dollars into Bitcoin, that will allow you to accumulate capital over time so that maybe you have to work less in the future. It's here today. You can take advantage of it. It's at your fingertips. Software, open source. You go download it, begin using it. It's a decision. It's a mental decision of recognizing, like we said, that the walls are down around the administrative state and the central banking system and the parasitic federal governments around the world. I will echo, I don't think we're going to fix our problems by trying to play within that administrative state. I think we have to build systems in parallel that are completely disconnected from these hierarchies that have led us to these dire situations. And Bitcoin, I think, is the most potent tool and mechanism that allows us to do that. So that's why I focus on it. And I have quarterly conversations with great individuals like Matthew to just keep drilling. Meme warp. Guess what?
Basic cash. Keep that in mind.
This is, hey. Everybody else will buy it. For anybody listening out there, this is a propaganda channel. I'm propagandizing sound money and built on a free and open source software. I will be open with that. I'm driving propaganda. Fix the money, fix the world. Bitcoin fixes this. Number go up. Bitcoin is freedom money. These are my propaganda slogans. I will.
Don't get in the weeds. CBDCs are never going to work. The money supply doesn't show that they're going any way to doing a CBDC. It's not going to help the banking system. You can unplug from all that and have basic cash, which you can. What was it? The Iroquois that was going 11 generations. How were they going?
Seven generation yeah. Thinking.
Yes, I heard that from you. That's a great point. Completely rewire your brain for those things, because that's how it was done in the past. Gold and silver, basic cash, shells, beads, things before that. Never really reached full basic cash, but that's same idea. You need something. Oh, one more thing. Sorry, it's tangents again. One more. You need it. You need it for two reasons. One is that heirloom. Nick Szabo wrote about that a lot in Shelling Out. One is the heirloom. One is passing it on. That's why you need basic cash. You can do that with fine art. You can do that with property. You got to get a fiduciary involved with property, right? You got to get the legal system stuff. Who knows? That property is going to hold value. Plus, it could become a liability for you, depending on the maintenance, management, all the rest. So it's an heirloom. That's what shells and beads and all the rest were used for, primitive basic monies to gold, silver, not a Bitcoin. Absolutely, it's an heirloom. That's a main point. Like, that's why you do it. That's it. It's for heirs. It's for passing on your savings to future generations. And then the next is if you have any concern with your trading partner on a non-local level. So if you're going outside of your home, where you're not going to see this person ever again, outside of your home area, right? So if you're, you know, in the West Indies or something trading spices, like you're never going to see these people again at best next season. You got to get the gold. You got to settle on even if you're 80% settled in goods, 20% settled on margin with gold or silver. Like that's why you have this type of cash. And those are like the real reasons. And those things still apply today. So Bitcoin can get you that international trade with people that you're never going to see again. Unbelievably fast. UTXOs renewed, destroyed and renewed again every 10 minutes. It's really remarkable. There's no other money like it in the world. So keep all those things in mind. That's why I'm doing the base money stuff. It really is like gold and silver.
And thank you for doing the base money stuff. I think it's important work. And you said this is 4 years in now. I think if you keep up with this, Porkopolis Economics is going to be one of the go-to economic data repositories on the internet. Because people need this good information. Like we've said many times throughout the years that we've been recording these episodes quarterly, nobody's getting this information. Nobody's gathering this data except for you. And I think the quality of the data is such that more and more individuals will realize that it is quality data and more eyes are going to be driven to it. And it will be used to drive home the argument that Bitcoin is better money and the central banking fiat monetary system that dominates the world today is failing and making the world materially worse off. So, as I do every time I come on, I have to thank you.
Much appreciated. Love what you're doing as well. Always happy to be on. Look forward to the next one. I mean, it's already end of June, so it's going to be it's going to be coming again. But then you got to wait a whole month. The central banks take forever, all the rest.
Well, yeah, so that's what I was going to... It does take time to do this, but it would be cool if the central banks make it possible to like release these numbers like the same day like GDP and inflation are released.
No way.
No way.
Not going to happen. No.
All right.
Korea still hasn't given me March yet. So they're all different. And at the end of the day, you do want... Like I thought about doing it like kind of as a running thing. Like I could give you... Right now in June, I could give you like a lot of stuff from March. I could also give you US through May. Korea would only be through February. But the better way is just to wait that full month when, like, you know, China doesn't come out for a month. Better way is just wait a month and then freeze it at most all of them end of March. Of course, the Bitcoin data I pull to the present, like I pull to, you know, whenever the
block.
Yeah. Yeah. And gold, silver as well. It's easy to pull the price. Anyway, that's a little bit into the nitty gritty of the methodology there.
We're at block 739,910 right now. You want to
look? I saw it day ahead actually on it was May 4th for a while for the next halving. It was May 3rd now on the block clock. I saw.
Interesting, because we've had a downward difficulty adjustment. It looks like we should have one today. Actually, it should be relatively flat.
As well. I didn't obviously look into it or anything, but I'm surprised at that.
Yeah. All right. Well. It is approaching evening, or probably is the evening now where you are.
It is indeed. Thunderstorm rolling in, summer storm.
Well, you go enjoy the evening with your family. I've enjoyed this conversation.
All the best to you. Absolutely enjoyed it. All the best to you. You have a major life event coming. Matt, super happy for you. Massive, awesome. Enjoy it. Best to the wife, best to the fam.
Thank you, sir. I'm preparing for very little sleep over the next couple, 6 weeks.
I mean, I'm still adjusting with one and you got your work cut out for you.
Yeah, it should be fun. Luckily, with my wife's mother in town, so she's going to help out the first couple of weeks. So that's shout out to my mother-in-law. Thank you for coming to help.
100%.
All right. We'll do this again next quarter. Peace and love, freaks.